From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, the I Chong, Meditations from the Joint. Tommy Chong was half of the baked comedy duo Cheech and Chong, who rolled their way to fame and fortune with marijuana-laced humor. Chong recently spent 9 months in prison after pleading guilty to conspiring to sell drug paraphernalia. His new book was written in jail. It's part memoir and part spiritual exploration. Also, we remember actor Bruno Kirby. He died Monday at age 57. He had countless roles in film, TV, and on Broadway. You may remember him from his films Good Morning Vietnam and When Harry Met Sally. And film critic David Edelstein reviews Half Nelson, about a high school teacher with a drug habit. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. As half the team Cheech and Chong, Tommy Chong became famous in the 70s for comedy performances, records, and movies about getting high on marijuana. Their characters were always stoned and were often being chased by inept cops and narcotics agents. Here's a scene from the beginning of Cheech and Chong's first movie, Up in Smoke. They're in a car when Chong offers Cheech a huge joint, almost the size of a baseball bat. Cheech asks what's in it, and Tommy responds.
Mostly Maui Wowie, man.
Yeah?
But it's got some Labrador in it.
What's Labrador?
It's dog.
What?
Yeah, my dog ate my stash, man. Had it on the table and the little ate it, man.
Yeah?
So I had to follow him around with a little baggie for 3 days before I got it back. Really blew the dog's mind.
You mean we're smoking dog, man?
Cheech and Chong starred in 7 films and had 6 comedy albums that went gold. In the mid-80s, Cheech and Chong went their own ways. Cheech Marin has since been in several movies and the TV series Nash Bridges and Judging Amy. Chong has played a stoner on That 70s Show and has appeared in the 2006 tour of The Marijuana Logs. He's just written The I Chong, Meditations from the Joint. It's a memoir and an account of his 9 months in prison. In 2003, he pleaded guilty to violating federal drug paraphernalia laws for his family's internet business that specialized in selling bongs made of blown glass. He spoke to Terry last year.
You've made your career, you've made millions of dollars doing comedy about marijuana and LSD before you were arrested for your son's business selling bongs and pipes. Had you ever been arrested for anything drug-related?
I'm very embarrassed to say that I've never been arrested before. It was a burden that I had to carry into prison. You know, people wanted to know why I was there. I had to kind of mumble, you know, cover my mouth and go, bongs. And when they arrested me, they thought for sure. In fact, Bill O'Reilly, you know, the commentator on Fox, he got on Leno one time, right after my bust, and said that the reason I got jail time was that I was busted for like 17 times, 17 priors, as he put it. But I've never been busted, and they triple checked that one to make sure. But no, I've never been busted. Well, you know, we got so many fans like at the border and cops and everything else, and so whenever they catch me with a little bit of pot, they'd kind of laugh and tell me about how they heard our records and let me go.
Oh, I know. I've always wondered about that. If cops often recognize you, because of course, in your movies, you're always being chased by cops, and you know, having to hide the largest joint known to man. So tell me more about what's happened over the years when cops did recognize you, or you know, border guards recognized you.
Oh yeah. Well, even coming in, I was just in Toronto with my wife. We were performing, coming back across the border, they recognized me. And but yeah, we have a lot of border guards. I do it in my act, you know, about how they recognize me and let me go.
You mentioned that they recognize you and let you go. Do you mean that they found things and let you go in spite of it?
Yeah, they found stuff. Okay. Right at the start of the Iraqi war, the first day, we're flying into Sioux City, Iowa, or flying out of it. We performed, my wife and I, and then someone gave me this big, beautiful glass bong water pipe, and I had it in my carry-on. And so when it went through the x-ray, you know, it created quite a stir, you know, the cops and everybody gathered around, they're pointing at the bong, you know. And the guy he talked into his lapel, like he called for backup or something, because he had this suspicious-looking water pipe in my knapsack. And then I told him who I was, and he went back to his lapel and said, "Disregard." And then I had some fans, National Guardsmen, you know, with rifles and everything. They said, "Oh, can we walk to escort you to your gate?" And I said, "Sure." And so I got an escort, and you know, it was great.
So what happened when you were arrested on February 3rd, 2003?
It was ridiculous. It was so scary in some ways. But the fact that I do movies, I live in Hollywood, you know, and I've been in so many shows, and that felt like a movie, a scene from an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, you know, where these guys bang on my door at 5:30 in the morning. They're DEA agents with visors and flak jackets and automatic weapons and helicopters and Fox News trucks out in front. And they come in my house and bang on my door. I open the door. They come rushing in, running from room to room. It felt like an Iraqi, you know. And they're kicking in the doors. They're running, yelling, clear. And they, you know, with their guns pointed at everybody and pointed at me and says, and they kept saying to me, you're not under arrest. It was like Alice in Wonderland. You're not under arrest. And the reason they said that is that they didn't have to give me a warning. I didn't, and I said, I better get a lawyer. And they said, you don't need a lawyer. We'll tell you when you can get a lawyer. It was, and they grabbed all the computers they could find. They grabbed all the bongs they could find. And they didn't have marijuana on their search warrant.
So did you expect to get prison time, or did you expect?
No.
What did you expect?
I was in denial. I was hoping I'd get house arrest. You know, because I got a nice house in Pacific Palisades. You know, I was looking forward to hanging around for a year, you know, working on my garden and just swimming in the pool and just kicking back. But, you know, and it's ridiculous. I'm surrounded by lawyers where I live. And so the lawyer across the street, he gave me the best advice ever. Yeah, he said, well, do the time. You know, you're not going to beat the feds. Nobody does.
You said that you took the rap to spare your son and your wife from having to do time. Mm-hmm. So what did they say to you about taking the rap?
My wife and my son?
Mm-hmm.
Well, my son was, you know, he felt really, really bad, you know. But, you know, rather me do time than him. So he went back to school, and he's becoming a lawyer. He's getting a law degree now. So, and a business degree. And my wife, well, she's so gorgeous. And we've been together for, like, almost forever, you know, 30 years. And she was quite upset. But then, you know, she'd never been alone, you know, so she lived alone. She had a single life for 9 months, and she enjoyed it. She got along fine without me. going out to clubs, dancing, having a great time, you know, and visiting me once in a while and looking so good. And then everything, because it was such a, I don't know, a non-crime, you know, it's like the universe said, don't worry, man, you're going to enjoy yourself. We're going to make everything work for you. You know, karma was good.
So what was the prison like that you spent 9 months in?
It was a camp. It was like a, but what it was, when you drove up to the camp, it was in near Bakersfield, a place called Taft. And it's the main prison, which houses, you know, the more dangerous people, had barbed wire all around it, you know, walls and very ominous looking place. And they take you in there, you know, and that's what freaked my wife out, because when they took me in there, it was like I was going to be in there. But then they held me in, you know, in a little holding cell for about an hour. And then I got in a little pickup truck, and we drove around the back where they have a camp. And it's a boundary camp where they have a chalk line around the track, around the whole camp. And you just can't go over that chalk line. And so there was no fences and no armed guards. And it was a camp. It was like a sports camp in a way, you know, or a religious camp, because a lot of religious things going on in a lot of different factions, you know, a lot of Catholics. And I got into the Indian religion, the American Indian, the sweat lodge. So we used to sweat every Saturday.
So what were most of the other prisoners in for?
White-collar crimes, a lot of white-collar crimes, a lot of pot growers. You know, they love arresting potheads or pot growers, because, you know, now they got people to take care of their gardens, and, you know, and we're mellow people, so we're the best kind of model prisoners.
Tommy Chong speaking last year with Terry Gross. We'll hear more of their conversation after this break. This is Fresh Air. We're featuring an interview with Tommy Chong. His book, The I Chong, Meditations from the Joint, has just been published. Here's another clip from his 1978 movie, Up in Smoke.
Hey, I got something to mail you out, man. You're just freaking out. Here. Take these,
what?
Man. Take these. This'll mail you out, man.
What is this, man?
Just take them, man. Oh. Hey, don't take those, man.
What?
I almost gave you the wrong shit,
man. Hey, man, I already took them, man.
Whoa.
Hey, what do you mean? Whoa.
Wow, man.
Hey, what was that, man?
You just ate the most acid I've ever seen anybody eat in my life.
Hey, man, I never had no acid before, man.
Geez, I hope you're not busy for about a month.
I'm gonna die, man. That stuff's gonna make me die, man.
No, that's good acid.
Hey, man, I never had it before, man. That's gonna make me die. What is this gonna make me freak out, man?
Man,
I seen those guys walk around my neighborhood had too many acid, man. Their head looked like a pumpkin like that, man.
Relax, man. Hey, mellow out, man. Now just go, oh.
What?
Do it, man.
That was Tommy Chong and Cheech Marin from their first film, Up in Smoke. Chong spoke to Terry Gross in 2005. She asked him about his childhood. He grew up in Canada near Calgary.
Your father was Chinese and your mother part Scottish, part Irish. So was like ethnic identity an important issue for you when you were growing up?
Oh, big time, you see. Our little town, we couldn't afford any black people or Mexicans. So we had a double for them. So we were the designated, brown people that had to be picked on, So I learned to fight at a very early age. But I was lucky I had a big brother that used to do all my fighting for me. But we grew up, it was a tough childhood, especially with hockey and all that stuff in there.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were in a band called Bobby Taylor and the Vancouvers that signed with Motown and had a semi-hit called Does Your Mama Know About Me? So how did you start doing comedy after doing music?
I was in a black band. I was the only non-black in a black band. And one thing about being in a black, it was a jazz blues band, and there's nothing but comedy in those bands. If you want to hear the best comedy in the world, just hang out with a jazz or blues band, and you will laugh yourself sick. That's how I got my start in comedy, it's just hanging out. And I never talked, when I was in the band, I never hardly said a word. I just listened. And so when Cheech and I got together, and then I had to come up with material, I had a lifetime worth of material.
How did you get together?
Cheech was up in Canada during the Vietnam War. He was part of the secret army that was up in Canada just in case a Viet Cong attack from Alaska.
Was he avoiding the draft?
Well, that was part of it. He was just out of university. And he was up there, and I had a, with the Vancouvers and that, we had a couple of nightclubs. We bought a couple of nightclubs because we needed a place to work. And one of the clubs was a strip club where it was actually Vancouver's first almost naked nightclub with the girls naked, that is. And I had seen an improv group called The Committee in San Francisco, and I seen another one called Second City in Chicago, like the original guys. And there again, I got this musician mind, I remembered the bits. And so I started showing them to the actors up in Canada. I put an improvisational group together with the girls. And so we
with
had
the
naked
strippers.
We had naked improv. It was incredible.
Oh, but you weren't naked, were you?
At times, but no frontal stuff, It's too cold up there. And we don't want to blow the myth. So the girls got naked. But, on cue, we'd play. We'd do little bits called, like, the pajama party, where they pretend they were in their living room and they change into their pajamas. Very sexy and very funny. And then Cheech joined up halfway through. We needed a straight man. Because I had another partner that had long hair. I had real long hair. And we needed a guy with short hair to play the cop parts. There was always a cop in there somewhere. But Cheech joined the group, and And then when the group broke up, as groups do, Cheech and I stayed together, and we were going to form a band, because he's a singer and I'm a guitar player. And I always thought I was just going to do this improv for a little while and then go back to a band. But then we formed a band, but we never played. We just went out and did comedy and in front of all these rock and roll kids, you know, about a couple of thousand, you know, screaming kids all sat down and watched our comedy. And so I knew that we were going to be very big in the comedy world.
So how did you start doing drug humor?
Well, it was because of the audience, you know. It was the times, and it was the late 60s. And the audience, you know, they were all stoned, so we would just sort of do something they could relate to. And like at L.A., for instance, when we were up in Canada, we didn't even know Cheech was Mexican, because, you know, he had an education and he was speaking, you know, like white guys. But when we come down to L.A., Cheech and I, we were in a club one night, and we weren't going over. We did one show, and then the second show. It was a dance club, and dancers don't like being interrupted, you know, for comedy, so they weren't that receptive. So I told Cheech, well, you know, there must be a character, you know, that they can relate to. And he said, well, there's one, but it's kind of detrimental to the Chicano population. I said, well, that's what we're doing. That's what we're comedians, man. And so he did it. And from that day on, I knew stardom awaited us. Because first time Cheech goes, hey, Red Freak, want a ride, man? We're hitchhiking. And then he talks about his car. Oh, it was magic.
So did you used to get stoned when you performed?
Yeah, at times. Usually the last show of the last night, Cheech and I used to smoke up a little bit just to make it interesting. But I haven't been stoned for 2 years, and so I do shows now totally straight. And like I say, there's no difference. I still forget everything.
Well, when you were doing your character, was it easier, like in the 60s and 70s, was it easier to do the character when you were straight or when you were high?
Oh, straight. Can't do anything when you're high. Especially movies. Movies is horrible. You got to be straight. Because you got cues, you know. You know. One time, Cheech and I smoked up, and we're sitting in a car. It was a car scene. And the radio says, okay, we're rolling. And for some reason, we were waiting for let's go or something. We sat there for about a half hour till the camera. They said, we're rolling. Oh, you know, we burned up too much film. So no. Life is better straight, by the way. It's so much better straight. But if you need to smoke, then that's another matter.
Cheech and Chong split up in 1986. Why did you split up?
Well, I joke about it, but it's kind of true, too. I didn't even know we were broken up till I went to the last Cheech and Chong movie and I wasn't in it. And I still have fans say, you know, my favorite Cheech and Chong movie, you know, my favorite movie of yours is Born in East L.A., and I was not in that movie. We broke up. The string had run out, you know, everybody, you know, from Sylvester Stallone, Madonna, everybody, you have a string of hits, Michael Jackson, everybody, you got the Beatles, you don't stay on top forever. Because what happens, you do 3, 4, 5, and then you start competing against yourself. And now you're 5, 6, 7 years older than your first thing, and you don't have that kind of energy. But Cheech and I, we ran out. That was it.
So, you know, the Cheech and Chong characters are going to be in their 60s in your new movie. So what are these characters going to be like?
Well, the title, the working title that I like is Grumpy Old Stoners. I think that's about it. In fact, I can tell you a little bit about it. Cheech has got a problem because when we hook up, you know, he's getting kicked off these movies, you know, because he doesn't look like Cheech and he's bald. So he's having a problem with his age, you know. Me, I'm still living with my mother. Who is the biggest pothead? But I'm on probation, so I can't smoke pot. Cheech's health stops him from smoking pot, so we come up with this solution where it's a salve, you know, like a lotion, and it's pot based, and it's magic because it doesn't show up in the drug test, and it gets you just as high, if not higher. And it's all the good stuff about pot, you know. It's all the mind altering substances, and so if you're mean and evil, it turns you into mild and sweet, and so that's part of the plot. And then there's, you know, we're being chased by Studenko again, the cop, and it's a big fun fest movie. It's going to be great.
Have you ever thought about how many times you've said the word man in your career?
We used to do manectomies in our records. We had to take them out because it was every other word was man. Hey man, you know what I mean, man. Hey man, what are you doing, man? And some of the records we'd go in there and just take out the man just so there wouldn't be so many of them. quite a few. In fact, that's what I call my character, Pedro and Man.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, Tommy Chong, thanks so much.
Thank you, dear.
Tommy Chong, formerly of the comedy team Cheech and Chong, spoke last year with Terry Gross. His new book is The I Chong, Meditations from the Joint. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Say, I dreamed about a reef of 5 feet long, a mighty mess, but not too strong. You'll be high, but not for long. If you're a viper, I'm the king of everything. I gotta be high before I swing. Let the bells ring, ding, dong, ding. If you're a viper, say you know you're high when your throat.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, in stores and online at bn.com. From Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation created by Andrew Carnegie to promote the advancement and diffusion of knowledge and understanding. And from Wellington Management, providing investment management for clients worldwide. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
Coming up, we remember Bruno Kirby. The actor died this week at age 57. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews Half Nelson, about a high school teacher with a drug habit. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead tells us about a new reissue from the late alto sax player Jackie McLean. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Jazz alto saxophonist Jackie McLean passed away in March. McLean was a disciple of Charlie Parker and a leading hard bop saxophonist in the 50s. In the 60s, he was a mainstay of the Blue Note label, where he liberalized his concept, even recording with Ornette Coleman. In later years, his bands often included his former students at the University of Hartford, where he'd taught for decades. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a reissue of one of McLean's 60s classics.
Alto saxophonist Jackie McLean recorded dozens of sessions for Blue Note between 1959 and 68. So many, some didn't find their way onto record for decades. Good ones are still trickling out on CD, and as time passes, he stands out more and more from the pack of post-Charlie Parker alto players. Jackie McLean was notorious for playing out of tune, but he always understood how wayward pitch can give force to a statement that playing in tune, quote-unquote, can't. That tension between African-American melody and European intonation is central to the blues. Jackie McLean from the newly reissued It's Time, recorded in August 1964. That was an exciting time for the jazz mainstream, responding to and feeding off the free jazz avant-garde. Andrew Hill was recording his Blue Note records that played games with time and texture. Miles Davis was about to hire Wayne Shorter, kicking his quintet into conceptual overdrive. The avant-garde's push for more flexible forms left its mark even on musicians who'd badmouth the movement, Miles being a classic example. But Jackie McLean was always open to new ideas to feed his bop-based concept. He kept pace with modal jazz and newly liberated rhythm sections, and he had a great ear for fresh talent. Miles had already stolen his young drum sensation, Tony Williams. Even the great Roy Haynes drumming here sounds like he'd been listening to him. Jackie's new discovery, who wrote half the tunes and makes his debut on It's Time, is trumpeter Charles Tolliver. Cecil McBee on bass and Herbie Hancock on piano. Back in 1964, rhythm sections like this one, or Andrew Hill's, or Miles Davis's, also with Hancock, cultivated a flexible way of playing time that was much imitated by the young lions of the 1980s. Any good rhythm section can make the music surge ahead, but these trios also made time and the form seem to stand still. They'd restrain momentum like it was some big, eager dog before letting it loose again. Of course, it helps if your saxophone player phrases like a drummer in the first place. Jackie McLean was 74 when he died this spring, far outliving many contemporaries who were also plagued with drug problems in their youth. Given the high attrition rate among jazz musicians, it's good to note all of his colleagues are still active as of 2006. In fact, trumpeter Charles Tolliver is in a late career resurgence, touring with Andrew Hill and with his own new big band record on the way. What goes around keeps coming around, which in jazz is not always a bad thing.
Kevin Whitehead teaches English and American Studies at the University of Kansas, and he's a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. He reviewed the reissue of Jackie McLean's classic album, It's Time, on the Blue Note label. Coming up, we remember actor Bruno Kirby. This is Fresh Air. We're remembering actor Bruno Kirby. Kirby died this week from complications from leukemia. In addition to being the character actor who was Billy Crystal's sidekick in When Harry Met Sally and City Slickers, he was featured in Good Morning Vietnam, This is Spinal Tap, Donnie Brasco, and made many television appearances. In City Slickers, Kirby's on vacation with two buddies in a Western cattle drive. In this scene, they're taking turns describing the best day of their lives, and it's Kirby's turn.
I'm 14 and my mother and father are fighting again. You know, because she caught him again. Caught him. This time the girl drove by the house to pick him up. And I finally realized he wasn't just cheating on my mother. He was cheating on us. So I told him. I said, you're bad to us. We don't love you. I'll take care of my mother and my sister. We don't need you anymore. And he made like he was gonna hit me, but I didn't budge. Then he turned around and he left. Never bothered us again. But I took care of my mother and my sister from that day on. That's my best day.
What was your worst day?
Same day.
Bruno Kirby in a scene from the 1991 film City Slickers. In 1974, in The Godfather Part II, he played the young Pete Clemenza, one of the neighborhood Sicilians who partnered up with Vito Corleone in the early days. He spoke Italian for the role.
C'è un amico che ha un tappeto buono. Può essere che a tua moglie ci piace.
Certo, ma gli altri che abbiamo soldi per cattare il tappeto.
No, io la va a regalare. Non saccio come ringraziare.
That was Bruno Kirby as Clemenza saying to Vito, a friend of mine has a nice rug. Maybe your wife would like it. It would be a present. I know how to return a favor. Robert De Niro played the young Vito. Terry Gross spoke with Kirby in 1990 after the release of the film The Freshman, a movie filled with affectionate references to the Godfather films. Marlon Brando plays Carmine Sabatini, a comic turn on his role as Vito. Bruno Kirby plays his nephew Vic, a low-level con man. In this scene, one of his marks, played by Matthew Broderick, demands his money back.
If you don't give me the money, like, immediately...
Clark, I would love nothing more than to be able to do just that. However... Here we run into an awkward moment. Tragically, I suffer from a gambling problem. Right after I left you, I placed a wager on a horse. Predictably.
You lost me money on a horse. All of it.
In retrospect, I'm not sure it actually was a horse.
Oh, God.
When you were preparing to play Vic, did you walk around New York a lot looking for scam artists?
The first thing I did was, when I was doing Tin Men, with Danny DeVito, he introduced me to a great guy named Cha-Cha. And Cha-Cha became a friend, and he has a little Italian cafe on Mulberry Street called Cha-Cha's in Bocca Lupo Cafe. And the minute I got this part, I called up Cha-Cha, and I said, look, here's what I need. Can I come down there with you guys? Can I hang out with you and your friends? Can I see a little bit about what that life down there is like? And Cha-Cha said, sure, come on, forget about it, anything for you. When I went down there, and... Cha-Cha isn't a scam artist by any means, but he was able to let me see, you know, he took me where they bought their clothes, he showed me where their loyalty was, he showed me the Chinese restaurants they like to eat at 2 o'clock in the morning, where they like to go gambling. And he was a very big help, and without him and his friend Butchie, then I could have never done it. In terms of scam artists and things like that, I never look for the negatives in my character. I can't play negatives. I don't think people in life... when they get up in the morning, you know, have negative ideas. And I think what Vic says every morning when he gets up is, what can I do today to please the person in the world who I respect and love the most, my Uncle Carmine? What can I do to win his love and respect?
Marlon Brando plays an organized crime head, and everybody comments on his remarkable resemblance to the Godfather in the movie, and there's a lot of Godfather jokes in this movie. Now, you were in Godfather 2, right?
Yeah.
Now, I have to confess to you, I don't remember your part in it. And
well, that's okay. That's a compliment.
Because I wouldn't recognize you in it?
I gained 60 pounds. I had my hairline shaved back. I spoke all Sicilian. I played Clemenza as a young man. When De Niro comes to America, I take him to steal a rug, and I introduce him to a life of crime. So I don't mind that you don't recognize me. To someone who likes to play different characters, that's a good thing.
How come you gained 60 pounds for it?
Well, the character of Clemenza is a very heavy character later on in the film. So I knew that we had to show that stuff starting to happen even in his youth.
See, I've always thought of you as the kind of actor who maybe grows a mustache for a role, you know, but who doesn't, not the kind of actor who puts on 60 pounds for a role.
Well, I do whatever's necessary. I mean, yeah. If you see The Freshman, that's not my hairline. That bald spot isn't mine.
Mm-hmm.
That receding hairline isn't mine. That's stuff I found from hanging out in Little Italy. You know, the character in When Harry Met Sally has a fat pad on at the beginning of the film. People don't even see it. But after he marries Carrie Fisher and she changes his life for the better, I took off the fat pad to show some kind of a, you know, she's made him a better person. She's got him exercising. He's not just sitting around bars at night drinking with the guys. He's doing things.
The movie that I really first started tracking you in, where I first started saying, oh, watch this guy, was Good Morning Vietnam. I don't know why it took me that long, but you play the lieutenant who thinks that Robin Williams should really stick to the Mantovani playlist.
Yes.
Tell me more about what you did to make this character so funny, because I really thought that you were actually one of the funniest things in the movie.
Well, you see, you can't really play a result. So you, I think the humor, when I approach a character, whether it's a comedy or a drama, I just approach it from their point of view. Now, what makes it funny sometimes is if a person is so sincere about their point of view that they can only see their point of view. So I think that's what gave that character the humor.
Furthermore, you want to stick to playing normal modes of music, not wild stuff. Those we would find acceptable here would include Lawrence Welk, Jim Nabors, Mantovani.
Percy Faith.
Percy Faith, good!
Thank you.
Andy Williams, Perry Como, and certain ballads by Mr. Frank Sinatra.
Would Bob Dylan be out of line?
Way, way, way out of line.
You played it as someone who really believes that they're right and
totally
smart and talented.
Totally.
And they really don't get it at all. They have no idea.
They have no idea, and I don't believe that this character woke up every morning and said, today, I'm going to be the biggest jerk the United States the United States Army ever produced. I think when he woke up every day and said, I have a great idea. These men are coming back from battle. Let me play soothing music for them.
Your father was an actor, right?
He still is. Great actor, Bruce Kirby.
What roles is he best known for?
Well, he was last seen, he was the head detective in Throw Mama from the Train. The first time around, when Jamie Lee Curtis had her TV series, he played her dad. And we're very, very close. We were born the same day. When I was born, I think my father just said, well, my best friend has arrived. And even though I was a kid, he would take me every place with him. He took me to Lee Strasberg's classes, and he'd say, sit down, just be quiet. He'd come home from work like 2 o'clock in the morning working as a waiter. He'd pick me up. He'd take me to 42nd Street. And we would watch Fellini films and Brando films. I was just a little kid, but we hung out together.
Did you like spending that much time with your father when you were young?
I loved it. It was sensational.
So did this get you excited about movies and about acting?
Well, you know what I think I saw? I looked at these actors, his friends, and I saw the camaraderie. I saw the stories, the way they would kid each other, put each other on. And I think I wanted to be part of it.
Was it helpful to have a father who was an actor, but not a father who was overwhelmingly famous, who you felt that you could never, ever live up to?
Well, I wouldn't know about the second part of it because, you know, I consider my dad to me knows more about acting than anybody I've ever met. He knows more about my acting than anyone. I mean, I remember when I was getting ready to do Good Morning Vietnam, I always give him my scripts and we always talk about my roles. I give him the Good Morning Vietnam script, and we're going to shoot the film in Bangkok. So I go by his house to say you know, to go over the script a little bit, but basically to say goodbye. It's the day before I leave. And I'm kind of running, you know, that kind of place you get when you're thinking about a trip, and he's talking to me about the character, and I'm just shaking my head, yes, 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 yes. And he says, okay, goodbye. I say, goodbye, Dad, I love you. And I start to leave, and he goes, wait, 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 Bruno, one more thing. I said, yeah, Dad, what is it? He said, you know, I think this is the kind of character who would send jokes to Reader's Digest. And I said, yeah, okay, okay, take care, I love you, goodbye. And I find myself on the set with Barry Levinson, and I say, you know, Barry, I just want to say something here. I just want to say that, tell Robin that Reader's Digest is publishing two of my jokes. And Barry, because he's got his own kind of genius, says, okay, but they're just considering publishing two of your jokes.
Do you often do that, by the way, add things to a character?
Yeah, constantly.
What's an example of something you added in The Freshman?
In The Freshman? Wow, let's see. Oh, I know some stuff that we added. Marlon is so facile. He has this thing where he starts, when the kid sits down, he says, you want a nut? And the kid says, no. I say, none for me, Uncle Carmine. And he says, you want some coffee to the kid? I say, none for me, Uncle Carmine. Well, that stuff, that part of the relationship wasn't scripted. In other words, we didn't know Marlon was going to offer him a nut, but I just instinctively knew that if I acted as if he was offering something to me too, that Marlon would totally ignore me. And it would give the character a different kind of shading. And that's one of the things that just kind of happened as we were shooting.
Do you have one of your earlier films that you wish were better known now because you really liked your performance in it?
I liked my performance in a film called Texas Legend, but they changed the title to Kiss My Grits. They did this to see if they could get me to kill myself, but it was one of the most painful experiences I've ever had in my life. I did this movie. It was produced by Tony Quinn. Bruce Davison was in the movie. He did a wonderful job. And I played a sheep herder from Texas. So I went down to Texas, and I worked on a sheep ranch. And he was just a good old boy, and he fell in love with this girl who didn't really care about him at all. And I thought I did a lot of wonderful work. But the company who released the film ended up doing a drawing in Variety of Bruce Davison and myself with our pants dropped, looking over our shoulders, saying, you know, kiss our grits. And the film was one of those films that shows up at about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. And it's, I'm sorry that I wasn't able to do, you know, that character someplace else where more people might have seen him. But otherwise, I don't have too many regrets.
Another question about The Freshman. When you were playing scenes with Brando, did it take a while before you stopped feeling intimidated? Did you feel intimidated
no,
at all?
No, not at all. He takes that right away from you. The first time I met him, I was waiting for him to come to rehearsal at Andy Bergman's. We're waiting. Matthew's getting a little edgy. Penelope Ann Miller's getting a little edgy because you're meeting Marlon Brando. You can't deny that. And he walks in and he looks at me and he says, you know, the last time I saw you, you had on a brown derby and a long coat and you were stealing a rug. Come here. And he gives me this hug. And basically what he's doing is he's absorbing all of my tension into himself. And 5 minutes later, you turn around and you're sitting around this table and you're working with somebody who I think is as good as it gets, and you're totally relaxed because of him.
I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Oh, thank you. This has been a lot of fun.
Bruno Kirby speaking with Terry Gross in 1990. Kirby died this week of complications from leukemia. He was 57. He survived by his father, Bruce, his wife, Lynn, and other family members. Coming up, David Edelstein on the new movie, Half Nelson. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Half Nelson, from the Brooklyn filmmaking team of Ryan Fleck and Anna Boden, was a big hit at this year's Sundance Film Festival and the Museum of Modern Art's New Directors Film Series. Now in a few cities, and opening wider over the next 2 weeks, it's a different kind of inspirational student-teacher movie. This time the teacher is a drug addict. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Ryan Gosling proved he was a major actor in The Believer. He was a fever Jewish neo-Nazi. Yes, you heard that right. And you'd have needed an advanced degree in math to diagram his emotional zigzags. Now he delivers a brilliant performance, a star-making turn, as a crackhead, alcoholic, inner-city junior high teacher in Half Nelson. The movie is pitched somewhere between a heartwarmer and a stomach-turner. Gosling plays Dan Dunn, whose addiction, like his disillusion with the state of American politics, is snowballing. In class, he hammers home a dialectical view of historical change. He champions men and women who dared to stand up against systemic injustice. But one day, after he finishes coaching his inept girls' basketball team, he slinks into a locker room stall and lights up. There he's discovered by one of his students, Dre, played by Sharika Epps. The girl had been waiting in vain for her estranged father to pick her up, and she's puzzled to see her white teacher semi-stuporous. But her face quickly settles into something harder. For Dre, this is the way of the world. A young African-American girl who tries to rescue her white teacher while he tries to rescue her, the Hollywood formula dangles right before our eyes, a rope ladder to La La Land. But not once do the director, Ryan Fleck, and co-screenwriter Anna Boden take the easy way out. Half Nelson is rooted in a world in which people rarely save anyone, or themselves. The movie's geometry is fascinating, because Dre's loving mom works too many shifts to look after her. Her brother's in jail after taking the rap for a friend, and that friend, Frank, played with electrifying charisma by Anthony Mackie, gives Dre money and takes an avuncular interest in her, maybe as a future courier. Well, Frank has supplied Gosling's Dan Dunn with crack, and he looks with complete incredulity when the teacher approaches him with a plea to keep away from the innocent girl. Everything in this universe is turned upside down. Half Nelson is full of squirm scenes, of the teacher sinking lower and lower, making a drunken spectacle of himself at basketball games, even forcing himself on a teacher he's been dating, and then recoiling in horror at how far he has degenerated. But the core of the film is the quiet, uninsistent bond between the teacher and the student. You can hear it even in the briefest but most pointed exchange, as they sit side by side on playground slides and consider each other's fates.
Hey. It's back.
Yeah. Did you know my brother?
I knew of him, but he wasn't in any of my classes or anything.
Think I could end up like him?
Do you?
Gosling flashes an awful lot of movie star grins that say, "Aren't I adorable?" Except the persona meshes perfectly with the character, who uses his own adorableness to keep the world at bay. The actor's sense of proportion is uncanny. He's light on his feet with a show of buoyancy, but so raw you can read every twitch of his wiry frame. Much of Sharika Epps's performance consists of watching him, and her face is so compelling that we begin to watch her in the same way, to see how much of herself Dre will risk revealing. What first seems like sullenness becomes more and more layered. It's her mere existence, not so much anything she says, that might be enough to save this would-be social reformer from the ultimate nihilism of addiction. It's unusual in American cinema to bring in big political ideas, but Dunn's rambling lectures on dialectical materialism to his puzzled junior high school students aren't lectures for the movie's audience. The context makes them impossible to take completely seriously. Half Nelson is a tricky exploration of the links and busted links between the personal and the political. It's the best kind of drama, dialectical on the outside and the inside.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Ferby is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from the Ford Foundation, committed to creating opportunities for people to live freer, better, and more prosperous lives. Online at fordfound.org. From the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities. On the web at wkkf.org. And from Rosalind Croman Swig, thanking the donors to the NPR Foundation and councils for their support of NPR programming. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, R&B legend Smokey Robinson. He's got a new album called Timeless Love. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
People say